pushing. We're electing, sorting, pushing. Cause the life are strong and pushing. We're electing, sorting, pushing.
Yeah, we're gonna save you, pushing.
You can call for a recount, but it's going to fail. You can't recount the ballot.
I don't know about you, but it seems to me that 4 years is a very long time. These last...
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Replacement players may be battling it out for the U.S. during soccer's World Cup qualifying match in February. The women's contract expires at the end of this month, and there seems to be little chance for the heated discussions to reach an agreement anytime soon. The men have been operating under a contract that expired in 2003, and the U.S. National Soccer Team Players Association recently refused to attend a two-week December training camp. The U.S. Soccer Federation struck back by canceling two qualifying warm-up matches to be held in January. The Federation has threatened to send a replacement team to the qualifying rounds in Trinidad on February 9th.
United Auto Workers members working at Delphi are anxiously waiting to see if they are among the 3,000 U.S. hourly jobs Delphi is cutting. The huge automotive supplier is slashing 8,500 jobs in all from its worldwide workforce. Delphi says it's taking aggressive cost-cutting measures due to the reduction in auto production by GM and rising commodities prices. The company says it expects to lose $200 million this year. The UAW and Delphi squared off in a bitter strike in 1998 at its Flint, Michigan facility that virtually shut down GM auto production in North America. The UAW at the time was resisting what it called the assault on jobs and outsourcing going on at Delphi. According to Delphi, it'll try to achieve the 8,500 global jobs cuts primarily through attrition and early retirement incentives. The UAW has not indicated how it will respond, but talks are ongoing with Delphi over the plan to cut the jobs. One of the issues in this move by Delphi is the cost of pensions and health care costs for thousands of UAW Delphi retirees.
The man who has been on the front lines of the country's biggest recent labor disputes announced his resignation Monday. Peter Hertgen, the director of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, cited personal reasons in his letter to President Bush. Hertgen was the key negotiator in a 2002 dispute between the International Longshore and Warehouse Union and the Pacific Maritime Association. That dispute included a 10-day worker lockout and the closure of 29 West Coast ports. He was also one of the mediators during the 141-day lockout of 70,000 union grocery clerks in Southern California. No successor has been named.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Total U.S. industrial production was up 0.7% in October after a mere 0.1% increase in September. That puts the industrial production index at 5.2% higher than its 1997 average. Mining and utilities led the industrial production increase. Part of this increase, according to analysts, is coming from a partial bounce back from the adverse effects of the recent hurricanes.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find AMIBA online at amiba.net.
Support our troops. Shout those magnetic yellow ribbons you see on cars and trucks anywhere in America. And it's certainly a sentiment that I embrace wholeheartedly. Our volunteer soldiers, as well as the reserves and National Guard, are putting their lives on the line every day for George W.'s ill-conceived and ill-prepared Iraq War. And every day, some more of those soldiers are killed. I believe that every one of the soldiers sent over there by Washington politicians deserves the fullest support available from those of us sitting safely and comfortably back here at home. But they are not getting it. Support our troops has to be more tangible than putting a yellow magnet on your car. That's rhetoric, not support. How many of us know, for example, that Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and gang have rushed our troops into that war without the protective armor required to save their lives from bullets and blasts? An unforgivable, scandalous failure of leadership that continues to this day. And how many of the yellow magnet people are aware of how our government, quote, supports those troops who die in Iraq? Well, it's been widely reported that the families of civilians killed in the horrible 9/11 terrorist attacks have received an average of about $3 million each in overall compensation. Do you know what the compensation is for the families of soldiers who were killed in Iraq? It's $12,000. A spouse is gone forever. A child has lost a father or mother. A lifetime breadwinner is taken from the family. Yet the White House, Congress, and Pentagon deems that life to be worthy of a mere $12,000. Even as the same public officials attend rah-rah rallies urging us to support our troops. And oh, by the way, vote for us! This is Jim Hightower saying, if you think the families of those who make the ultimate sacrifice deserve more than empty rah-rah and $12,000, call Operation Truth at 212-982-9699.
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
1 in 4 adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricidin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coricidin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coricidin HBP. Use as directed.
Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, coast to coast, border to border. Streaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, into cable systems in 29 states on Cable Radio Network, archives at WhiteRoseSociety.org. You can find our live chat room if you want to drop in at TomHartman.com, as well as archives of the program. In our second hour today, we're going to get into the question, what is the greatest danger to America, hunger and homelessness, or Janet Jackson's breast? That we actually didn't even get to see the whole thing. In any case, our third hour, is Rummy going to get fired or here, or might he be arrested when he shows up in Germany? Interesting, strange things going on. I want to get into the struggle within the Republican Party that we're seeing some evidence of, these meetings today, these economic meetings. There's a schism forming that I think is fascinating. But in our first hour, the question, is an armed society a more polite society? Gun Owners of America Communications Director Eric Pratt is with us. Hey, Eric, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much, Tom. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Hey, what's your website, Eric?
www.gunowners.org.
Gunowners.org. Okay, great. And in this news release I have from you, it says hang on just a second, Eric. There's a suspicious-looking guy outside the window. Let me, 30. You know these double-action guns, you got to cock them before you can... there, we got him. I think I got him. Okay. All right, we're in good shape there. Nightclub survivors... Is this mic still working? I guess it is. The nightclub survivors are extremely fortunate. Oh, he's still limping out there. Are extremely fortunate that an officer arrived so quickly, said Pratt. Many times the imminent danger is over long before police can reach the scene. Here's the question. Is an armed society a more polite society?
Well, I think the record from the states is that the jurisdictions that have enacted stringent gun controls, like Washington, D.C., where they've passed bans where good people aren't allowed to protect themselves, those are the most dangerous places in our countries. However, the places, the states that have enacted right-to-carry laws that allow their citizens not only to have guns at home but carry them out on the street are actually the states with the lowest crime rates.
Well, Washington, D.C. is kind of a lousy example, though, isn't it? Because you've got abutting states that are, you know, you can walk from one state to a second state into a third state in a half an afternoon. I mean, that's true.
Now,
a lousy example.
Then you have to ask the question, why then aren't those guns a problem? I live in Virginia, right next door to Washington, D.C. The murder rate we have here in Virginia is like less than 5 per 100,000. Even in the big cities, it's extremely low. So the question is, the guns are more accessible here in Virginia. Why aren't they a problem here? Why do they only become a problem when they get transported into D.C.? And I would submit the answer is because when they go into D.C., it's only the bad guys that have them, and the good people who, by and large, because they want to be law-abiding, have complied with the ban, and therefore they're unarmed victims.
Now, there are some folks who would suggest that the bad people you're talking about are the poor blacks in Washington, D.C., and the good people are the white Republicans in Virginia, and cast this as either a racial issue or as some sort of a crime issue. What if it's simply a poverty issue? I mean, why is it that Canada has actually more guns per capita than the United States, yet while we have 8,000 or 9,000 gun-related deaths a year here in the United States, they have fewer than a couple hundred?
I don't know that they have more guns per capita than the United States. I think what we're seeing in other countries,
they
for example, England is a prime example of that. I mean, if gun control and a gun ban was ever going to work, you would think it would work on an island because there are no abutting states. You know, you have to either swim there or float there. And yet England, which passed a very stringent, draconian ban after a horrible schoolyard massacre in 1997, has found that actually their murder rate, their crime rate is shooting through the roof. The United Nations recently did a study and found out that in England, their violent crime rate is the highest of all the Western nations, even higher than the United States.
Are you talking about gun crime here, Eric?
Traditionally, the police used to just carry the nightsticks. They're actually having to move towards arming themselves so that they compete and control the violent armed gangs that are just flourishing.
Right, but it sounds like you're playing with numbers a little bit here. The number of gun-related crimes have gone up since England restricted. I mean, it hasn't in Australia. Australia had that massacre in 1997. And the government called, they passed a law, it was the most significant gun reform in the history of Australia, which has, sort of like in America, a Wild West tradition of everybody owning a gun. And a ban on semi-automatic rifles, a ban on pump-action shotgun, registration of all firearms, licensing of all shooters. They basically said a gun is like a car. You know, it can be used to kill people. And if you're going to have a driver's license to drive a car, you're going to have to have a license to own a gun. And you're going to have to prove that you're proficient. And 643,000 guns were turned in. That would be the equivalent of 40 million guns in the United States. And since that time, there's been a 28% decline in homicides. There's been a 16% decline in suicides. Gun crime is down in Australia.
Tom, I haven't seen those statistics that you're talking about for Australia. I'd like to see that. But what I'm telling you is in England, gun crime is up. All crime is up in England, and that's according to the BBC. That's according to the United Nations study. The mayor of London.
So, are you suggesting then that
said that he actually feels safer in New York City than he does in London? Now,
okay, so you know, I'll give you that, and let's assume that that's the case. Are you suggesting then? I mean, is therefore the argument here that gun crime is up in England because there was a ban on guns in England? Or is gun crime up in England because England, like much of the rest of the world, is suffering some very severe economic times right now?
I think there are many factors that lead to crime. However, I think it can be easily shown in our own country, again, that when you allow the citizenry to be able to protect themselves, because let's face it, the police cannot be there in most cases to protect people. There's almost 200,000 violent crimes a year where the police cannot be there in time to protect the people. So when you allow the citizens to protect themselves, that that is quite a deterrent to criminals, and they will typically go elsewhere to perpetrate their trade.
So we have a situation here.
Criminals may be criminals, but they ain't stupid. Obviously, they're going to try to find gun-free zones or weapons-free zones where they're going to be the only ones with a gun.
So you got a situation here where on December 9th, a guy walked on stage in a crowded nightclub and started shooting. It's famous. You know, it's a dime bag. Daryl Abbott got shot, got murdered. And the police showed up and took this guy out, the guy who was shooting at him. But you're suggesting that if half the crowd had been armed and everybody had whipped out their gun and said, ah, there he goes, let's get him, bang! Yeah. Another hole in the wall. I'm sorry.
Actually, if everybody there, and obviously that's mere speculation, because in the states that have concealed carry laws, you don't find that half the crowd has a firearm, except maybe at a gun show. And by the way, shootings don't occur at gun shows. But, you know, who knows? Maybe this guy wouldn't have decided to do that. That's exactly what's happened. Just look at Israel. I mean, you do have half the crowd in Israel carrying a gun, and they actually have a lower murder rate than we do, even though they're embroiled in with terrorism attacks. In fact, that's why the Palestinians have resorted to going to the suicide bombers, because the showing up on a street corner trying to wipe out half the the patrons at a restaurant on a street, that just didn't work.
Well, it's because the army's around. It's not
fire.
Come on.
They had civilians firing back at them. They could kill no more than one or two Israelis at any one time.
Eric, we're talking with Eric Pratt. He's the Director of Communications for Gun Owners of America. Eric, I've spent a lot of time in Israel. I've never seen anybody carrying a handgun. I mean, we used to drive around the country. You pick up soldiers hitchhiking. They got an Uzi over their shoulder. They're all over the place. But that's you're talking about a country that is essentially in the midst of internal military occupation.
Because we've been there, too. Employees of Gun Owners of America have been there. They give out firearms and concealed carry permits like candy. In fact, obviously they have universal conscription in Israel, right, which for that reason you do have many people who are actively in the military. But
right, but can you cite me one situation where somebody who wasn't in the military and carrying a military firearm in Israel actually took out a bomber or a terrorist?
Oh, my. It happened twice in 1 week a couple of years ago. The first time it was
a
woman who shot the suicide bomber before he could detonate his bomb in a supermarket. And then 1 week later, a shoe salesman did that to when he was dining with his wife in a restaurant. So twice in 1 week, two suicide bombers were killed before they could pull the ripcord.
So this is the solution in America. Everybody should carry a gun.
Tom, look at the statistics. The five states that have the lowest crime rate in this country.
It's just simple yes or no, Eric. Should everybody be carrying a gun?
All have right to carry laws.
Sure. I mean, I live here in Vermont, and oddly, the last time I talked about this topic was about 6-8 months ago, and I now have three bullet holes in my car.
Tom, do you realize that Vermont
I'm not kidding,
every year is ranked as the safest state in the union, and you guys have the best concealed carry law in the country?
This gun that I've been sitting here shooting at my desk, I don't even have to tell anybody I've got it here in Vermont.
In Vermont, people don't have to even go to the state to ask for permission to carry a firearm. You can just do it. I mean,
I know. I'm telling you. I think that this is, in my personal opinion, this is something that should be handled on a state-by-state basis to some extent. But that's splitting hairs. I'm really interested in the larger issue here of what kind of society we want to be.
Let's not breeze by this. If free access to guns was the problem, Vermont should be the Wild West, but it's not.
Yeah, so you're making my point. My point is that this isn't about the access to guns. Yeah, my point is that this isn't about the access of guns. This is about a culture in crisis, and a good chunk of that crisis has to do with the fact that we have rampant underemployment and unemployment. You have people who are, the vast majority of gun crimes are done against people who are relatives. You have to acknowledge that. The vast majority of gun deaths are spouses killing each other, kids accidentally killing each other, or people committing suicide. That's the vast majority of them. And those, in most cases, are the consequences of the economic disaster in America. I'm suggesting that this whole gun argument, should we have guns, should we not have guns, to what extent should we be regulating and controlling them? There is a rational space in there for that discussion, but that the larger discussion is being completely avoided by pretty much everybody, which is that our economy is melting down, and folks like you are saying, well, the solution is simply to arm everybody, and I'm saying the solution is to give everybody a decent job.
Well, okay, I mean, there are other issues that that involve why there is crime, but the point is that you as an individual, you as a husband, or you as a father, how are you going to protect your family? And, you know, so, you know...
Well, and do it effectively, because the reality
causing crime. The fact is, when you have an intruder in your home, what are you going to do? If you pick up the phone and dial 911, it may be more than an hour.
I absolutely understand, Eric. We got to take a break here. But we'll pick it up on the other side. I understand. And the odds are, if I keep a gun in my home, that you know, 5 times more likely that somebody's going to commit suicide with it. 20 times more likely that somebody's going to be accidentally killed with it than I will ever stop an intruder. And those are the odds we got to play. 20 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Eric Pratt. We'll be right back.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
If you sell a product or service, we have listeners from coast to coast and in 97 countries who want to know about you. Reach out to our national audience with our small business advertising package. You'll pay just a fraction of what national advertising usually costs. Call now at 802-229-2288 or visit our website, tomhartman.com, and follow the links to the small business advertising package for more information. Don't miss reaching a national audience now. 802-229-2288.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza Man.
Hey, you're not the Pizza Man. You're the cable guy again.
Price Patrol.
No, you're not. I can see your van. You're the cable company. I'm not going to let you raise my rates again. I'm calling American Satellite to get a DirecTV system.
Presidential candidate.
Are you going to offer me over 125 digital quality channels for as little as $39.99 a month, including my local channels?
Ice Cream Man.
Yeah, like that's going to work. If I call American Satellite right now, I can get a 4-room DirecTV system, including professional installation free. Can you beat that?
Pizza Man.
You already tried that. Well, that's it. I'm calling to get my DirecTV system.
call 800-505-1546. That's 800-505-1546. For new customers only. Annual programming commitment required. Ask how you can get your first 6 months for only $29.99 a month, a $60 value. Offer ends July 17th. Call now, 800-505-1546.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes.
And welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Eric Pratt, Director of Communications for Gun Owners of America, National Gun Lobby with over 350,000 members. Eric, your website again is...
Gunowners.org.
Eric, let's take a few phone calls here. Here, find out what our listeners are thinking about this. Let's go first to Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Rick, you're on the air with Eric Pratt.
Yes, good day to you, Tom and Mr. Pratt.
Hello, Rick.
Are you related to the Larry Pratt who was the president of this organization?
I sure am.
Is it your dad?
Yes, he is.
Okay. I guess you folks have heard that... your group is supposed to make the NRA look like the moderates in this debate. Have you heard that?
I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you, Rick.
Is there a specific question or point you want to make?
I don't know about a specific question, but I guess the point you made, Tom, is very apropos there about the chances of other bad things happening, like shooting your spouse late at night or suicide or accidental shooting. And Mr. Pratt, I think when you mentioned Vermont being... one of the safest places to live. You know, that might be because we have good people like Tom there.
Actually, I think it's the majority of the guns here in Vermont are not handguns. There are very few handguns.
I've lived here
for 10 years. It's mostly hunting rifles that people have here. There's a lot of them, but there's a lot of handguns.
But, I mean, the interesting thing is they have one of the most liberal congressional contingents with Bernie Sanders, Patrick Leahy, and James Jefferson.
Yeah, but there's an awful lot of conservatives out in the backwoods. Rick, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Alan in Pennsylvania on the line. Alan, your thoughts.
Yes, I'm from Birmingham, Alabama, where they have a concealed law where you carry a gun.
Yeah.
And I think they have one of the highest homicide rates in the country there.
Eric?
I don't know that that's the case. And I'd like to address this whole idea which the previous caller and you, Tom, have been saying that you're more likely to be harmed by a gun in the home. That's just simply not true. Tom, your buddy, Bill Clinton, his Justice Department, a few years back in 1997, did a study and found that 4,000 times a day people use a gun in self-defense. Now, when you compare that, that's 1.5 million times a year. When you compare that to the 30,000 gun deaths every year, that means
Eric, that number's been used
50 times more to save life than to take life.
Yeah, that number, Eric, has been just really, really thoroughly debunked. I can't believe you're still using that stuff.
That was Bill Clinton's own Justice Department. It has not been debunked. People can go to our website at gunowners.org and read that. I mean, your figure of the 5 times more likely, that was the bogus statistic. That was done by Arthur Kellerman, who would not release any of his data. When he finally did release his data, it was discovered why he wouldn't release his data for years and years and years, because it turned out that all the deaths in the home that he had looked at, actually those people were killed by guns that were not kept in the home. In other words, the criminal coming into the home had killed the gun owner in the home, but they hadn't been killed by their own gun. So it was a completely bogus statistic.
You're talking about this. A gun kept in the home is 22 times more likely to be used in an unintentional shooting. A criminal assault or homicide.
And by the way, that's
an attempt at a completed suicide.
It goes up and down depending on the anti-gun researcher that's doing the study. But I'm saying, look, just go to the Clinton's Justice Department, 1997, 4,000 times a day people use a gun in self-defense.
So the logic of this, Eric, is that
more is that we should than guns are killing people.
Is that we should simply all? Alan, thanks for the call. Let's go to Daniel in Little Rock. We've only got about a minute left here. Hey, Daniel, quick one.
Okay, this is a kind of an emotional issue for me because I did have my younger brother committed suicide using a .357 Magnum, and
as did my best friend when I was 16 years old.
I'd like to say that I'm not anti-gun, but I'm anti-automatic and some of the semi-automatic, like you said, handguns. I lived in Australia during the time that all this went down, and they decided to have the buyback program. And I'm sorry, I just believe you don't need a machine gun to shoot a deer. And also the argument about the Constitution, I'd like to point out that the...
Well, Daniel, I gotta stop you there. We'll get into that a little later on, but I just want to give Eric, we've only got about 5 seconds. You can have the last word.
Well, I appreciate you having me on the show. Again, people can go to our website at gunowners.org. We have a lot of fact sheets there, a lot of original source studies. And if people would like, they can sign up for our free email alerts. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks. Eric Pratt, Gun Owners of America. It's Tom Hartman, 29 minutes past the hour.
Mom, I can't believe you asked Rick all those questions. Where do you live and who are your parents? It's so embarrassing.
Getting to know your kid's friends isn't easy. But if you don't, he's more likely to do drugs.
Geez, you have to know everything?
Actually, Sean, I do. Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for Drug-Free America.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Replacement players may be battling it out for the U.S. during soccer's World Cup qualifying match in February. The women's contract expires at the end of this month, and there seems to be little chance for the heated discussions to reach an agreement anytime soon. The men have been operating under a contract that expired in 2003, and the U.S. National Soccer Team Players Association recently refused to attend a two-week December training camp. The U.S. Soccer Federation struck back by canceling two qualifying warm-up matches to be held in January. The Federation has threatened to send a replacement team to the qualifying rounds in Trinidad on February 9th.
United Auto Workers members working at Delphi are anxiously waiting to see if they are among the 3,000 U.S. hourly jobs Delphi is cutting. The huge automotive supplier is slashing 8,500 jobs in all from its worldwide workforce. Delphi says it's taking aggressive cost-cutting measures due to the reduction in auto production by GM and rising commodities prices. The company says it expects to lose $200 million this year. The UAW and Delphi squared off in a bitter strike in 1998 at its Flint, Michigan facility that virtually shut down GM auto production in North America. The UAW at the time was resisting what it called the assault on jobs and outsourcing going on at Delphi. According to Delphi, it'll try to achieve the 8,500 global jobs cuts primarily through attrition and early retirement incentives. The UAW has not indicated how it will respond, but talks are ongoing with Delphi over the plan to cut the jobs. One of the issues in this move by Delphi is the cost of pensions and health care costs for thousands of UAW Delphi retirees.
The man who has been on the front lines of the country's biggest recent labor disputes announced his resignation Monday. Peter Hertgen, the director of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, cited personal reasons in his letter to President Bush. Hertgen was the key negotiator in a 2002 dispute between the International Longshore and Warehouse Union and the Pacific Maritime Association. That dispute included a 10-day worker lockout and the closure of 29 West Coast ports. He was also one of the mediators during the 141-day lockout of 70,000 union grocery clerks in Southern California. No successor has been named.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Total U.S. industrial production was up 0.7% in October after a mere 0.1% increase in September. That puts the industrial production index at 5.2% higher than its 1997 average. Mining and utilities led the industrial production increase. Part of this increase, according to analysts, is coming from a partial bounce back from the adverse effects of the recent hurricanes.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Yeah, there's that guy out there in the street. He does look suspicious here. Let's see what happens. Yeah. Ah! I think I got him that time. There we go. All right. Yes, an armed society is a polite society. Boy, that cordite stinks. Anyhow, welcome back. Tom Hartman here. Yeah, I probably the limiter. Just cut that right off. It's you shoot a gun near a microphone, and all the equipment just goes nuts. Just shuts down. Doesn't take it. Anyhow, 1-866-889-8894. Daniel in Little Rock, Arkansas. You were in the middle of making a point. We ran up against a break. I dropped your call. I should have hung on to you. If you want to call back and finish your point, you're welcome to. I would like to talk about the Second Amendment and what that has to do with all of this. And John in Grand Rapids is on the line. Hey, John, what are your thoughts on all this?
Well, I'll tell you, Tom, it's a good thing that I and most of your listeners don't have a gun, because we would kill ourselves after listening to your program. I mean, your world, it's a good thing that you've been so successful at business too, Tom, because otherwise you'd kill yourself, because life has to be really, really tough.
John, what do you have to say besides this, besides these rather pathetic attempts at a personal attack? You want to talk about the issue?
Well, it was during the issue that you were talking about the fact that we are killing each other because this economy is in a meltdown. I mean, how can you?
Well, as a matter of fact, John, when you go back and you look at the study that was done by the British Medical Society and published last year in The Lancet, under the conservative administration of Margaret Thatcher, both homicides and suicides went up. And they looked at the trends in the UK and in the US, just in those two countries, and they found that as average pay of the middle class went up, homicides and suicides went down. And as average pay of the middle class went down, homicides and suicides went up. And they tracked in both countries. And you know, it's just a reality. You can't deny it, John.
Well, I'm not going to argue about that.
Most of those homicides and suicides were done with guns.
Liberal statistics have been wrong, much more than they've been right. But my point is that you said this economy is in a meltdown, and I'm not going to let you get away with that garbage.
Well, okay,
you
here's
possibly say that,
John.
You have any kind of credibility at all when you say something that outrageous? Any way you can measure the economy, it has been on the rebound. It's doing well. And any way you can measure it.
Okay, here's how I measure it, John. I'm not measuring the economy based on how well somebody who earns their living by sitting around the pool waiting for their dividend check to arrive
is doing. Oh, that's good.
Okay.
That's good.
But here is a measure that I, you know, address this, please. My consideration of the health of an economy, I agree with Thomas Jefferson that the purpose of an economy is to provide for the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness of the people. The whole point of economic...
I don't believe he said anything like that.
Well, he did, actually, at length. There's an entire chapter about it.
Not the way you're
saying. In his words, in my book, What Would Jefferson Do, if you want. I don't have the book right in front of me, so I can't quote it. But and historically, everybody has agreed that the reason why we have economic activity is because it does something useful for us.
Yes.
So let me make my point, John. John,
like
John, just calm down for a second. Let me make my point. You said by any measure, this economy. Here's the any measure that I would say. If the average person's pay is going up, or if their purchasing power is going up, or if the ability of a single wage earner to put their kids through school, pay for their medical expenses, and have a healthy retirement is going up, then the economy is getting stronger. And you look at any of those measures, John, by any way you want to measure it, and ever since 1980, they have been steadily declining across both Republican and Democratic administrations.
Your facts are just not accurate. They're just, I could find all kinds of people who would refute what you say.
But
it's just ridiculous.
No, I'm telling you the truth,
and
John.
You talk about the middle class shrinking. That's one of your big things. And
that's right.
You
know, what is happening is, John, how old are you?
I am 52.
Okay, John, we're about the same age. Don't you remember, John, when we were both in our 20s, when the majority of Americans could work and one person working could raise a family, put them through school, have good full medical insurance, and have a pension? How can you be 52 years old and not have noticed that there's massive underemployment in the United States now, that you've got two, you know, more than half of all the children in America are coming home to an empty house?
Oh, jeez. Yeah, but, you know, that's because of people like you, because of liberals.
Ah.
We have a lot of those problems.
I see. It's all those people who want a minimum wage. That's the problem.
I really doubt the facts that you use, Tom, because liberals have typically used facts for so many issues in the last 50 years that are just wrong, whether it's global warming or the abortion issue or especially the Cold War.
Yeah.
In Russia, you guys have been way off the wall.
John, just, you know, broad generalizations and calling people liars is not going to get you anywhere.
I'm not calling you, well, there are certainly liars on your side. I'm not calling you a liar,
yeah.
But I am saying that you use facts that are just not true.
Okay. Thanks a lot, John. I appreciate it. When you have a specific fact that you want to use to refute that, give me a call back. I'd love to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Daniel in Little Rock, Arkansas, back on the line. Hey, Daniel.
Hi. I just simply wanted to make the point about the Constitution that was written at a point in time when we needed a militia,
yeah,
and didn't have an Army, Navy, Marine Corps. And that was it, basically.
Well, in fact, it goes beyond that. It's really interesting. If you go back and you read the letters between Jefferson and Madison in 1787, after Madison had shepherded through the Constitution, he was very proud of this thing, and he sent a copy. He was kind of the father of it all. And he sent a copy to Jefferson, who was the U.S. envoy to France. He was in Paris at the time. And Jefferson sends him back a letter saying, I really like this thing, and it's marvelous, and here's what I like about it. And he says, now I'll tell you what I don't like. And he goes through and he says, there's got to be a Bill of Rights. And he lists the things that should be in the Bill of Rights. And his list, everything that is in the current Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, was in Jefferson's list, plus two others. One was, Jefferson said, there must be a ban on monopolies in commerce, which is a whole other rant that you probably heard me get into before.
Right.
And the other was, Jefferson said, there must be a ban on standing armies during times of peace. And in other letters, principally with Ben Rush, but also with James Madison, Jefferson expanded on that considerably. And I pulled a lot of this stuff out and put it in my book, What Would Jefferson Do?, in which I am suggesting that we should have, I agree with Jefferson, we should have universal conscription. Every single citizen of the United States at the, upon graduating from high school should spend a year of service, giving a year of service to their country. And we should have a citizen's army like Switzerland does. And this is what Jefferson was suggesting, that every single family, at the head of the family at the very least, that in every single family there be a rifle in the house. And now the things have changed. Times have changed, of course, but this is how it was in the 1700s, that there be a rifle in the house and that person is a member of the militia, but there is no army unless the country's invaded. And if the country's invaded, then the bells ring a particular way and everybody grabs their gun, steps out in front of the house, and boom, the entire nation is the army. And he had two arguments for this. One, he didn't want there to be an army when we were in times of peace, because he said it would become a power unto itself. You would have, this is the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about, that the military, and Jefferson pointed, to all the nations throughout history that had been, where governments had been overthrown by their armies. So, he considered armies something to say, worry about, let's say. But secondly, and perhaps most importantly, is if every citizen is a member of the army, then the army is not, not going to be going off doing things that the majority of people don't want. This is one of the reasons why these guys don't want a draft. It's one of the reasons why we're not going to have a draft. But in any case, Jefferson was saying we must not have an army. Instead, we must have a citizens' militia, and we did, by the way, at that time. And therefore, because we're going to say there shall be no army in time of peace, only a navy. There would be a navy to protect our borders, but no army during time of peace. Therefore, every citizen must be part of the citizens' militia, and in order to maintain a well-regulated militia, the right of citizens to carry arms shall not be abridged. They don't have the right to own a battleship. They don't have the right to own a cannon, but they, the right to own a gun shouldn't be abridged because they're part of the military. And the Second Amendment came out of that debate. It was the leftover second half of that debate. Jefferson didn't get his ban on an army during times of peace. And what was left, he was rather unhappy with, and hoped that it would eventually come back, and they could go back and fix this thing and put back in. Right up to his dying days, he was still arguing that we needed to have a ban on a standing army. When he became president, there were over 300,000 men in the army. He cut it down to 6,000 by the time he left in 1808, which you know, for which he was criticized. A lot of folks say that, you know, Madison, the War of 1812, that we were somewhat unprepared because the army was so small because Jefferson had cut it. That's a whole other debate. But anyhow, that's the genesis of the Second Amendment. And it's important to get it out. Daniel, thanks for calling and sharing that and bringing that up. And my condolences to you on your friend. I had a similar experience. Thinking back, it was when I was 19. And my best friend, his name was Clark, his first name, and we had gone up and spent a summer living in teepees in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We were very, very close. And he got drafted. This was during the Vietnam War. Let's see, when I was 19, that would have been 1968. Or no, that would have been 1970. And Clark came home for Christmas from boot camp. And I remember he came over to visit me, and he was really depressed. They were going to send him over to Vietnam, and he was just wretched about it. He didn't know what to do, and I didn't know what to suggest. I listened to him, but that was it. And later that night, I got this hysterical call from his wife, saying that she'd come home and found that he had gone into the bedroom, put a gun in his mouth, pulled the trigger, and blown the back of his head all over the wall. And I went down there and God, it was a mess. And that's the main use of guns in the United States. 1-866-889-8894. Steve in Roswell, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. Love your show. A minute ago, I heard something about statistics being skewed, and I just wanted to point out one that I think is misleading. Kind of a misnomer. When we're talking about, say, 6% unemployment, and it goes to, say,
7%,
that 1% doesn't go from, 95% unemployed, 95% employed to 94% employed. Those people become 100% unemployed, and they become desperate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's just obvious that when unemployment goes up and conditions become worse, and especially if they start cutting welfare programs.
Yeah. John, I think that these unemployment statistics have become essentially meaningless. During the Reagan administration, they started playing with them. Bush Sr. played with them again, deciding, you know, well, let's not count people after a certain number of months if they're not unemployed. And then they were counting, they say, how many hours does somebody have to work and still be considered unemployed if somebody gets a job where they pay, where they work 10 hours a day. Now we're to the point where if you work 1 hour a week, you're not considered unemployed. We're not measuring underemployment. There is a group that came up with this thing they call the misery factor. Somebody can Google search it. Maybe somebody in the chat room can track it down. That I thought was actually a pretty good index of, it was an index of a bunch of things. But we need a better way of figuring this out because the unemployment numbers are just nonsense these days. They're just nonsense. They're largely meaningless. Because they play with these things so much. For example, if you have a big spike in unemployment, and then you know automatically, even if you maintain that same level of unemployed people, 18 months later, suddenly your unemployment numbers are going to start going down. Why? Even though those people haven't found work, they're no longer getting benefits, and so they're no longer counted as unemployed. And here we are. I mean, that's sort of what's happening right now. And you've got these large numbers of people who are unemployed and massive numbers of people, millions of people who are underemployed. Over 40 million people can't even afford health insurance. And this is a great economy? Well, it's a great economy if you make your money in the stock market. It's a great economy if you're a millionaire, but it's not a great economy if you're trying to make your living, raise a family by working 8 hours a day, by and large, I would say.
Right. Fortunately, I am 100% employed. I'm self-employed, and I feel grateful for that. But I've been on the other end of it.
Yeah, yeah, and it ain't pretty.
No, it ain't pretty, and thank goodness we do have welfare programs that catch people going through the cracks.
Yeah, as a social safety net.
Watch and maintain it. I mean, the spirit of the whole thing is obviously that the common is important.
Yeah, I agree with you, Steve, and thank you for the call. I'm with Franklin Roosevelt on this. The best form of welfare is a job, and I'd much rather see the government running programs like the WPA. Say, okay, if there are unemployed people, instead of just tossing welfare money at them, let's hire them to build our bridges. Let's hire them to do art for the buildings downtown. They had an art component to the WEA. If that's what it takes to get people back into the working place, then, you know, then that's what it takes. And I think that we should collectively participate in that. Derek in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Derek, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. Just had a question on that last comment. I was wondering if you're actually serious about the main use of the guns in the United States. I mean, that's kind of one of the most ridiculous things I've heard. The millions of guns that are owned, you think the main use is for people to commit suicide?
Well, thanks, Derek, for keeping me straight here. The honest and true main use of guns in the United States is to hunt with. But I'm you know, absolutely. And probably the second most common use is to commit crimes with. So if that was your point, I agree with you. But the reality is that if you look at the number of people who die as a result of handguns, in 1998, there were 30,708 people in the United States who died as a result of handguns, okay? 12,000 of them were murdered, 17,000 were suicides, and 866 were accidents. So, you know, figure it out yourself. Derek, thanks for the call. I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 10 minutes before the hour, it's a Tom Hartman radio program. The pill that will help you escape the matrix.
Bonjour, my name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
Scientists document the decline of amphibians around the world, and they say the same problem could hit other types of animals in the future. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. Amphibians are extremely sensitive animals, and their numbers are in decline. A recent study found that one-third of all amphibian species are at risk of extinction. That adds up to about 1,800 species altogether, and of those, several hundred are headed toward extinction rapidly. The study is called the Global Amphibian Assessment. It was directed by Simon Stewart, a biologist who works for the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Stewart says disease and climate change appear to be two particularly nasty problems.
The amphibians have narrow ecological tolerances, and so they are often the first species to be affected by new emerging threats, as has proven to be the case in these declines associated with disease and climate change. If the global environment continues to deteriorate for reasons such as these, and especially if climate change continues, it can only be expected to affect other groups of species that are hardier and more robust.
Stewart uses the word sinister to describe problems that now threaten amphibians. He says they were unpredicted and unpredictable. He says similar problems could hit birds and mammals in the not-too-distant future.
I think as long as we continue to let the basic life support systems of the planet erode, we're going to see more sinister happenings like this. The amphibians are important in their own right, we believe, but they're also a wake-up call for many other things.
The full report is available online. The web address is globalamphibians.org. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
The Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air.
And democracy is coming to the United States, says Canadian Leonard Cohen. It's irony, I suppose. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Folks in the chat room tell me that the American Misery Index is equal to the inflation rate plus the unemployment rate plus the interest rate. And when you look back, and this was first calculated by Chicago economist Robert Barrow in the 1970s, they've been running it continuously since then. And when you look at the misery index, Carter, under the Carter administration, it was plus six. That's, you know, plus numbers are, you know, things are better, minus numbers are things are worse. Reagan, minus five, Bush, one, minus 12, Clinton, plus 23, Bush, two, minus 13. And here are two recent, this is from What Would Jefferson Do? Two recent exhaustive and thorough epidemiological studies done in Australia and the United Kingdom show that when conservative parties take power, suicide increases dramatically, whereas when the liberal Labour parties rule, suicides drop. This is in Australia and the UK. Kendall Powell notes in an article, Suicide Rises Under Conservative Rule. That's the title of the article in the journal Nature. This is a science, this is the top science journal in the world, not a political journal, the journal Nature. Suicide Rises Under Conservative Rule. The researchers accounted for the effects of drought, both world wars, and the availability of sedatives. Even so, men and women were 17 and 40% more likely to take their own lives respectively with conservatives in power, that in the Australia or the UK. Nature quotes University of Manchester psychologist Gary Cooper as confirming, quote, poorer social support and higher job insecurity drive more to suicide under conservative regimes, end quote. The British study, which looked at suicide in England and Wales from 1901 to 2000, is a 100-year study, was so compelling that a BBC report noted, quote, the figures suggest that 35,000 people would not have died had the conservatives not been in power, end of quote. That from Nature magazine, published last year. I'll tell you one quick call here, Thomas in Louisiana on the line. Hey, Thomas. What's
How
up?
You doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Well, I was listening to the comments earlier about gun control and the suicide rate and what guns are used for. And I just recently did a paper for college and figured I'd call in and give a few more interesting facts on gun use.
Okay. We only have about a half a minute.
The actual percentage of accidents and stuff that happen with guns is higher for trained professionals using guns than the average gun in the home.
But that's because they're using the guns more frequently, isn't it? I mean, that may be an artifact, that statistic.
Absolutely correct. That is because of the usage.
Right.
They're using them a lot more. And then you also have the fact that the crime rate using guns is far less in areas where gun use is allowed by the private homeowner, whereas in areas where it's not.
Yeah. Well, which, you know, I'll give the gun guys that. I mean, it makes a certain amount of sense. And Is that the problem? I mean, this is my issue. I don't think that we can divorce the issue, the debate about guns, from the debate about what kind of economy and what kind of nation we want to live in. I mean, which is why I think, again, you get back to this issue of, in Canada, they have more guns per capita, and they really do. Most of them are hunting rifles, like I said, and they have fewer murders per capita. Thanks for the call, Thomas. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way: to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Replacement players may be battling it out for the U.S. during soccer's World Cup qualifying match in February. The women's contract expires at the end of this month, and there seems to be little chance for the heated discussions to reach an agreement anytime soon. The men have been operating under a contract that expired in 2003, and the U.S. National Soccer Team Players Association recently refused to attend a two-week December training camp. The U.S. Soccer Federation struck back by canceling two qualifying warm-up matches to be held in January. The Federation has threatened to send a replacement team to the qualifying rounds in Trinidad on February 9th.
United Auto Workers members working at Delphi are anxiously waiting to see if they are among the 3,000 U.S. hourly jobs Delphi is cutting. The huge automotive supplier is slashing 8,500 jobs in all from its worldwide workforce. Delphi says it's taking aggressive cost-cutting measures due to the reduction in auto production by GM and rising commodities prices. The company says it expects to lose $200 million this year. The UAW and Delphi squared off in a bitter strike in 1998 at its Flint, Michigan facility that virtually shut down GM auto production in North America. The UAW at the time was resisting what it called the assault on jobs and outsourcing going on at Delphi. According to Delphi, it'll try to achieve the 8,500 global jobs cuts primarily through attrition and early retirement incentives. The UAW has not indicated how it will respond, but talks are ongoing with Delphi over the plan to cut the jobs. One of the issues in this move by Delphi is the cost of pensions and health care costs for thousands of UAW Delphi retirees.
The man who has been on the front lines of the country's biggest recent labor disputes announced his resignation Monday. Peter Hertgen, the director of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, cited personal reasons in his letter to President Bush. Hertgen was the key negotiator in a 2002 dispute between the International Longshore and Warehouse Union and the Pacific Maritime Association. That dispute included a 10-day worker lockout and the closure of 29 West Coast ports. He was also one of the mediators during the 141-day lockout of 70,000 union grocery clerks in Southern California. No successor has been named.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. Total U.S. industrial production was up 0.7% in October after a mere 0.1% increase in September. That puts the industrial production index at 5.2% higher than its 1997 average. Mining and utilities led the industrial production increase. Part of this increase, according to analysts, is coming from a partial bounce back from the adverse effects of the recent hurricanes.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find Amoeba online at amiba.net.
Who loves you, baby? Merck, the giant drug maker, loves you. That's who? Well, this assumes that you're one of the 230 senior executives at the company. Merck is showing its love to its top executives by giving each of them a brand new gleaming golden parachute. What about the other 30,000 employees? You're on your own. Goodbye and good luck. Those executives might need their parachutes soon, for Merck is in trouble. As widely reported, its best-selling drug, Vioxx, has been found to cause heart attacks in many of those who take it. Not a good selling point. Merck withdrew Vioxx from the market, but subsequent evidence indicates that its executives had known about this little side effect for quite some time, but didn't disclose it to regulators, doctors, or the unsuspecting patients who took the stuff. The company now faces federal investigations and thousands of lawsuits. Since the withdrawal of Vioxx, Merck's stock price has plummeted by 40%, on top of a 30% fall the company had already suffered because of its failure to develop promising new products for the market. All of this makes Merck a likely target for takeover by another drug giant. Takeover threats make top executives very nervous, for the company doing the taking usually ousts the old team and puts in its own. Hence, Merck's sudden rush to provide executive parachutes. If another company takes over Merck, or even buys as little as 20% of its shares in an effort to take it over, the 230 top dogs become eligible to bail out with a special payment of 3 times their annual salaries, plus their expected bonuses, as well as stock payments. For example, CEO Raymond Gilmartin, who helped engineer this sweet deal, would get about $57 million to soften his landing. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, this does amount to top executives rewarding themselves for their own failures and taking care of themselves without regard to the fate of others.
The notion of a 40-hour work week is several hours short of reality. Working long hours is a given when you run your own business. To help make that easier, Sam's Club carries quality 3M products. From Post-it notes to Scotch tape, you'll find a wide variety of the 3M products your business relies on at everyday low costs. After all, we know that time and money are important to you. Helping you make the most of both is why we're here. Sam's Club. We are in business for small business.
1 in 4 adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coracetin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coracetin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coracetin HBP. Use as directed.
Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, the Republicans are getting together right now, trying to figure out what they're going to do to us all. How much more can we take? How more effectively can they make sure that people who are in their living sitting around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive pay less and less in taxes? And those of us who work for a living or who own small or medium-sized businesses pay more and more in taxes. And big multinational corporations pay nothing at all in taxes and, in fact, get a bigger piece of that $152 billion this year in corporate welfare, actual payments to corporations, welfare payments, compared to $41 billion in welfare payments to humans, of all welfare payments of all types in this year's budget. So what are they up to? Well, the Wall Street Journal has a pretty good summary of this, actually, today, by Shalaga Murray,
Sorry, Shalaga, if I'm mispronouncing your name. Anyhow, it's a very nice roundup piece. The headline, Republicans size up priorities. The subhead, Alaska drilling, legal reform, seem doable with bigger majority. So what are the Republicans? They're having this. It's interesting. David Brooks, I should have printed it out and shared a piece of it with you. It's in today's New York Times. David Brooks writes about how the economic summit meeting or conference or whatever that the cons are having at the White House today and tomorrow, or near the White House. Maybe it's not in the White House. I think it is, though. In any case, that this meeting is basically nothing but the toadies. You know, they should rename the White House Toad Hall. Because it's the as Doonesbury, the Department of Toady Affairs. It's whatever Bush says. If you don't say yes, sir, that you're brilliant, sir, you're out on your butt. Just ask Colin Powell or Paul O'Neill, for that matter, who is about as conservative as they get. And so they've got John Snow with the chairman of the Business Roundtable. And we'll be sharing some more information with you as the week goes on about the Business Roundtable. Louise was digging into that today. Didn't finish it. We didn't get it all wrapped up here. We'll get back to it. But the Business Roundtable, in short form, is a club, a group, 100 members. They are the CEOs of the 100 largest corporations in America. You talk about your special interest groups. And the chairman of the Business Roundtable, the head of it, 3 years ago, was the head of, what was it, CSX? The remnants of the old steel company that had merged with the railroads and whatnot. Used to be U.S. Steel. I may have the acronym wrong. And that, of course, was John Snow, who is now the Treasury Secretary. So the Republican leaders are going to, what are they up to? Well, Murray in this politics and policy column in the Wall Street Journal suggests that they have some very specific priorities. Number one, they want to pass changes in asbestos litigation. Now, this is very important to Halliburton. Halliburton bought, under Dick Cheney's watch, while Dick Cheney was president of Halliburton, they bought Dresser Industries. And Dresser Industries had been a big user of asbestos going back to the 40s when they were building ships. And there's a lot of folks who ended up with mesothelioma, which is a particular type of lung cancer that you only get from exposure to asbestos. I mean, there might be a few other things that might cause 1/100th or 1% of the cases, but mesothelioma is a very aggressive, very deadly form of cancer in the lungs, or actually in the lining of the lung. It gets into the pleura, the area between the lung and the rib cage. And it's an awful form of cancer, and when it takes people out, which it usually does in just a matter of months, it does so in a pretty ferocious way. And so, of course, and the first time that it was published in the medical journals that asbestos exposure caused mesothelioma was in the 1930s. So this is something that these companies have known for a long, long time. And when I was a kid, you could buy asbestos ironing board covers. I remember my dad was the office manager. He ran a tool and die shop in Lansing, Michigan, and I remember I used to go down there and they would get steel wrapped in asbestos. It looked like cardboard, corrugated asbestos. It was like corrugated cardboard, and I remember just being fascinated by this stuff because I would sit there and break it into little pieces, and you could see the fibers. Oh, that was just the most fascinating thing, that this was actually a mineral, and it had these fibers. It was just all over the place. They had buckets of asbestos that they would take hot steel and set in to cool down slowly. Very entertaining, huh? Anyhow, so there's a lot of people who have mesothelioma and asbestosis and lung diseases associated with this. And
And they are suing Dresser Industries, a.k.a. Halliburton, among other companies. But this has, Halliburton's Dresser division, in order to get out of having to pay these people for their pain and suffering, because they were selling these asbestos-containing products, even though they knew at the time. I mean, the state of the art of medical knowledge at the time was that asbestos causes a variety of illnesses, including and particularly mesothelioma. Some people call it mesothelioma. So one of the priorities of the Republicans is to bail out Halliburton by changing the asbestos litigation rules, by saying that if somebody gets killed or gets sick as a result of exposure to corporate asbestos, there's an absolute cap on the amount of money they can get. Because some of these people are getting, you know, $2, $3, $4 million judgments. You know, how much is a life worth? How much is being lied to worth? And beyond that, I mean, the real reason why juries give big awards to people is not so much to say, you know, your life is really worth $5 million. Or even, you know, if you're going to suffer with this, you know, asbestosis for the next 15 years, you're going to be laid up and you're going to require constant care and oxygen and everything else, and that's going to cost you, you know, $200,000 a year for the nursing and the medical costs, and say you're going to live another 10 years, that's $2 million, $200,000 times 10. And so we're going to award you $2 million just to take care of the medical expenses. And then on top of that, we'll toss in another $1 million because for 10 years you won't be able to work. So that's the equivalent of $100,000 a year to support your family. And we'll toss in another $500,000, which would be the equivalent of your pension that you'd make, but, you know, because you won't be getting it because you're dead, but this will take care of your wife and family. That kind of, it's not just that. The main reason why juries give big awards is to say to the corporation, how dare you have lied to your employees? How dare you have exposed the American people to something you knew was going to cause death? We are going to make it so painful for you to do this to people that you will not think about doing it in the future. Well, this is something the Republicans don't like at all. They call this frivolous litigation, excessive awards. And they want to say, you know, if it's predictable, then we can make a business decision around this. You know, it's like, I forget whether it was Ford or General Motors, but they were outed by, I'm pretty sure it was General Motors, in Unsafe at Any Speed. Ralph Nader outed these guys back in the 60s. And for an extra couple of dollars, I think it was $2.30, something like that, for a couple of bucks, they could have made their car safe. And they calculated how many people were going to die as a result of, you know, rear-end collisions that would lead to the car catching on fire that would cause somebody to die. And they said, well, if we design it this way, it's going to cause, let's say, you know, 300 deaths if we sell 1 million cars. And out of those 300 deaths, let's say half of them sue us. And let's say that the average judgment is $250,000. So now we have 150 settlements of $250,000 each, and whatever the math is on that, that's going to add up to less than the amount of money that it would cost to spend the extra $2.50 each on 1 million cars and make them safe. So we'll just make them unsafe because we can do the math on this. And this is what the Republicans want. They want it set up. And not just the Republicans, there are conservatives on the Democratic side who agree with this logic as well. They want to set up so a business can look at this as a pure business decision and say, okay, we're going to make a decision. We're going to include some asbestos in this product, or we're going to make this product in a way that might kill people off. But, you know, it's going to kill off a small enough number of people that at $250,000 a person, we'll still make a profit. So if it only kills off 0.1% of the people who use it, and we have to pay $250,000 to say only 10% of them ever get around to successfully suing us, can hire a lawyer. And if it's capped at $250,000, a lot of lawyers won't even take it because, you know, it's going to cost them $100,000 just to get expert witnesses. And after that, they split the fee and the lawyer's got nothing.
for nothing worth, you know, a 2-year legal battle. So it can just be calculated as a cost of doing business. This is what they call tort reform. A tort is a legal damage, right? And when they're talking about tort reform, what they're saying is not reforming the laws regarding torts so that we, you and I, the people, have greater protection from corporate malfeasance, but rather so that corporations have greater protection from the possibility of us suing them and some jury saying, you know, we're going to teach this company a lesson so they stop doing this. They shouldn't be killing people like this. It's just wrong. So that's at the top of their list, tort reform. Also on the list, the plan is to add ANWR language. That's drilling in Alaska to next year's budget resolution. This is very popular in Alaska, by the way, because the state of Alaska splits up the profits from the oil with all the citizens of Alaska. The resolution not only will likely impose harsh spending caps on domestic appropriations, but also could be used as a vehicle to order cuts in benefit programs in an effort to reduce the record budget deficit. So they're talking about, what can we cut? Let's see, we can cut Social Security, we can cut Medicaid, we can cut the welfare program. We're not going to cut corporate welfare. In fact, we're going to increase that. Yeah, the Republicans hope to pass at least one legal reform bill. Talked about that. White House Economic Conference begins today on the high cost of lawsuit abuse. The other issue is Social Security. You're right. They know Democrats were itching to draw attention to their causes and insisted the Tennessee Republican, that's Bill Frist, allow votes on unrelated issues like drug imports and the minimum wage. Frist wouldn't let it happen, so the class action lawsuit bill didn't pass. I'll tell you about that after the break, and we'll take a few calls. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Bonjour, my name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique! And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir!
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. If you'd like to help bring the Tom Hartman program to a radio station in your area, please let us know. We have tools to help you make that happen. For more information, go to www.tomhartman.com and click on the Bring Tom Show to Your Town link on the left side of the page. Thanks for your help in bringing uncommon sense from the radical middle to your community.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's the hard national.
Yeah.
It's the hard national.
Get that in your pipe and smoke it.
Then
read it. Uh-huh. It's for all my homies in Bruges.
It's the hard national.
Yes. Welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. This is the place where smart people get their news. Speaking of smart people's news, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
How you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm doing okay, but I'll tell you something. Yesterday, they had a series of sort of what they call deep background briefings for us on Social Security, for those of us in the press at the White House.
Uh-huh.
Well, they don't want to raise the amount we put into Social Security, which is the 12.2% or 12.4%. They don't want to raise the caps. In other words, people who are paying, who get a salary above $90,000 a year, at that point don't put any more into Social Security for that year until the next year.
Right.
So those two things are off the table. Well, now they want to do these little savings account deals, right?
Yeah.
Where you would put 2% of your, of your paycheck into the stock market, et cetera. Now,
right.
Even Alan Greenspan says once you are able to do that, then the government has an interest in propping up the stock market and jimmying around with the financials and putting pressure on the Fed, et cetera.
Right.
That's problem one. But the second thing they're not telling you is, let's say, Tom, your Social Security benefit is $1,500 a month, and your 2% garners you the equivalent of 40% on its money or something, you do really well, and let's say you're able to somehow generate $800 or $900 a month income from that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're not telling you that you're necessarily going to get to keep that $800 or $900 a month. It may just reduce the amount that the government pays you of your defined benefit.
I'm confused.
Okay.
You mean that if individual investors put money into their individual accounts that are handled by Wall Street, that's being handled as an aggregate kind of lump sum by the that the government still has some claim to it?
Well, right.
Or is this more like SEP accounts?
We're going to reduce the amount proportionately of the amount that we put in every year.
Oh, I see. I see. You mean the employer's share?
No, your share at the end. You're 65 years old. You have a benefit of $1,500.
Oh, okay. In other words, they're going to decrease the, let's call it Social Security Classic. They're going to decrease the Social Security Classic payments because you're earning more on your Social Security new payments, your Social Security private payments.
They haven't said that they're going to do that, but they also didn't say when we questioned them yesterday, there were only 10 of us in a room, that they were necessarily going to take that off the table.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a Ponzi scheme. The whole thing's a Ponzi scheme.
I nearly fell off my chair. I was in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. I'll tell you, Tom, you could have wiped me up from the floor. I was so shocked.
Yeah.
And then I said to them, well, what does it do for you if you change the line? In other words, if you make people who are earning over $90,000 a year still contribute, and then you make Bill Gates means tested. Now, a lot of the liberals are against means testing. I am not one of these people that's against means testing.
Yeah, me neither.
I don't see why Bill Gates needs to get a Social Security check. But what if you do that? What does it do to the, you know, the system? Well, guess what? They didn't.
It fixes the system, Ellen. It fixes it. I mean, if you eliminate the caps, you don't even have to have means testing. If you eliminate the caps...
Well, they say if you eliminate the caps, it, according to the Bush statistics, it will only fix the system to 2024.
Oh, nonsense. The system is solvent right now to 2042, period, as it stands.
That is not... Well, it is solvent in terms of not the money that's currently in the...
The problem is that they've spent a couple trillion out of the trust fund that they're going to have to pay back. But it,
exactly.
But if they pay that back, which they have to, they have a legal obligation to, it's solvent until 2042. It's amazing. It's all the games these guys are playing just so they can hand some of our money to Wall Street.
I just thought you'd be interested.
Yeah, well, I do. Ellen Radner, the Talk Ready News Service. Ellen, thanks so much for our daily report from Washington, D.C. Great to hear from you. We'll talk to you tomorrow. 29 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Replacement players may be battling it out for the U.S. during soccer's World Cup qualifying match in February. The women's contract expires at the end of this month, and there seems to be little chance for the heated discussions to reach an agreement anytime soon. The men have been operating under a contract that expired in 2003, and the U.S. National Soccer Team Players Association recently refused to attend a two-week December training camp. The U.S. Soccer Federation struck back by canceling two qualifying warm-up matches to be held in January. The Federation has threatened to send a replacement team to the qualifying rounds in Trinidad on February 9th.
United Auto Workers members working at Delphi are anxiously waiting to see if they are among the 3,000 U.S. hourly jobs Delphi is cutting. The huge automotive supplier is slashing 8,500 jobs in all from its worldwide workforce. Delphi says it's taking aggressive cost-cutting measures due to the reduction in auto production by GM and rising commodities prices. The company says it expects to lose $200 million this year. The UAW and Delphi squared off in a bitter strike in 1998 at its Flint, Michigan facility that virtually shut down GM auto production in North America. The UAW at the time was resisting what it called the assault on jobs and outsourcing going on at Delphi. According to Delphi, it'll try to achieve the 8,500 global jobs cuts primarily through attrition and early retirement incentives. The UAW has not indicated how it will respond, but talks are ongoing with Delphi over the plan to cut the jobs. One of the issues in this move by Delphi is the cost of pensions and health care costs for thousands of UAW Delphi retirees.
The man who has been on the front lines of the country's biggest recent labor disputes announced his resignation Monday. Peter Hertgen, the director of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, cited personal reasons in his letter to President Bush. Hertgen was the key negotiator in a 2002 dispute between the International Longshore and Warehouse Union and the Pacific Maritime Association. That dispute included a 10-day worker lockout and the closure of 29 West Coast ports. He was also one of the mediators during the 141-day lockout of 70,000 union grocery clerks in Southern California. No successor has been named.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. Total U.S. industrial production was up 0.7% in October after a mere 0.1% increase in September. That puts the industrial production index at 5.2% higher than its 1997 average. Mining and utilities led the industrial production increase. Part of this increase, according to analysts, is coming from a partial bounce back from the adverse effects of the recent hurricanes.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
tirelessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today, as pretty much every day, by Small Dog Electronics. High technology for low prices. You can call them at 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, although they carry much more than just Macintoshes. But they are one of the nation's premier Macintosh suppliers, support, the whole thing. 1-800-511-MAX. And the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com or 1-888, you can call them at 1-888-ECO-WINE. It's an interesting story to tell you about organic wine. We'll do that in the first hour of the program tomorrow. Our quote for the day from Ralph Waldo Emerson, following up on yesterday's NLP lesson. Our greatest glory is not in never failing, but in rising up every time we fail. Our greatest glory is not in never failing, but in rising up every time we fail. Ralph Waldo Emerson, our quote for the day, apropos to the discussion going on in the chat room just a moment ago about the kind of damage that the you know, 4 more years of Bush in the White House is going to do to the United States, is doing aggressively the damage that these guys are doing to the United States. And my point, I said this in the chat room, and I'll say it on the air, my point is that it's not the president that has the power. The president has the bully pulpit. And George W. has certainly been using his phony war to grab more power and certainly access to much more money for his buddies. Halliburton now has passed the $10 billion mark of handouts from the government with regard to Iraq now. In the midst of all these scandals of ripoffs and whatnot. But beyond that, the real power is the House and Senate. And this is where, in my opinion, the Democratic Party, and again, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not speaking as a Democrat, but there's not another viable party on the left. The Greens, you know, God bless them. I encourage people to join the Green Party, participate with the Greens. The Greens are doing wonderful things at the local level, and in a few states, it's actually rising to the state level. And here in Vermont, we've got the Progressive Party. But in the major races, the governor races, the gubernatorial races, the congressional races, the senatorial races, at the federal level, it's got to be the Democratic Party. And I agree with Howard Dean. It's got to be us taking it back. I frankly am skeptical about how that, you know, if that's going to happen. There is this battle going on for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party, just as there is for the heart and soul of the Republican Party. And we're going to see how this thing spins out or how this plays out. But the real power is not the presidency. It is the House of Representatives. That's where the real power is in the United States, because all spending is initiated out of the House of Representatives. The ability to declare war comes out of the House. And then secondly, you've got the Senate, which has to provide advice and consent for the confirmation of cabinet officers and judges, as well as a bunch of other functions that the Senate performs, plus any piece of legislation that originates in either body has to be agreed to by the other. So taking back the House and Senate, but most importantly, taking back the House, this is what the Democratic Party needs to be focused on. It's what you and I need to be focused on. This needs to be the focus of political activity in the United States among Democrats, liberals, progressives, and people in the radical middle. You know, people who are concerned about, are we going to have decent jobs again in America? Are we going to repudiate the Republicans / New Democrat / Democratic Leadership Council / Republican Light notion of free trade, free that is from multinational corporations? I guess it frees American workers too. They no longer have jobs. You are hereby freed from your job. And go back to a rational trade system, to rational trade policies, rebuild our industrial infrastructure. Stop acting like a third world nation where we're exporting raw materials and importing finished goods. See, the difference is the finished goods contain labor added to them.
So it means somebody had a job somewhere other than in the United States. And now you're getting into this part of the Republicans are meeting and they want to drill at Anwar. At the same time, the Eskimos are seeking to recast global warming as a rights issue. Let me tell you about that right after this. First, let's go to the phones. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Bob in Grand Rapids, Michigan. A lot of calls from Grand Rapids today. It must be a pleasant day there, Bob. How you doing?
Tom, it is a very pleasant day, and I am doing well. Thank you. Tom, I don't know if you ever experienced it or not, but my father had the unfortunate that happened in his life where he died from lung cancer caused by asbestos.
Yeah, and my father has mesothelioma at this moment.
Well, then you understand the pain that they go through mentally and physically and even spiritually.
Yeah.
And it is one of the most agonizing things for the whole family. It's not only does the patient suffer that way, but you do as well because there's nothing you can do for them.
Yeah.
But one thing I did want to say to you, Tom, one day the American people will wake up with your help.
And yours, Bob.
See these things, and the light bulb will go on.
Yeah.
Things like asbestos and the rest of it will all cease to be.
Well, it's going to take more than just me. It's going to take you too, Bob.
Well, this may be true, but you're turning the light bulb on an awful lot of people. As you said, you've been getting quite a few calls from the Grand Rapids, Michigan area.
Yeah. Yeah, and I appreciate it. It's interesting. There is a general awakening, I think, happening in the United States. I've been saying this for years. People, the despair began with the election of Reagan, right? There were a lot of liberals who were going, oh, no, this is it. You know, he's just a dumb movie actor, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, no, this isn't the end of the world. But here you had the most criminal administration in the history of the United States. More people indicted or convicted of crimes, of felonies, who were members of the Reagan administration than any other administration in the history of the United States. And it reflected that greed is good mentality, that government as a stepping stone to wealth, the beginning of fascism, the beginning of the merging of corporate and state interests. It just reflected that. And then Clinton came along and everybody said everything's going to be wonderful, and I'm like, no, you don't get it either. You know, Clinton is not really a liberal, and he's going to do some good stuff, but it's going to go halfway. And plus, you've got the House and the Senate after the first midterm election in the hands of the Republicans, or at least the House, and it's just not that simple. But the reality is, you know, when Kevin Phillips back in the 70s wrote his book The Emerging Republican Majority, a lot of people just didn't think that would happen, and it did. And now there's a book out called The Emerging Democratic Majority, and you look back on the waves of the cycles of history, and they just seem to go like, you know, every other generation, basically. It just flips. Every 20 years or so, it just flips back and forth. The pendulum goes back and forth, and it's going back to the left and to a rational left. I don't think we're going – I pray we never go
rational,
to –
Rational we don't need –
Yeah, I pray we never go to anything like communism or something like that. I mean, it's nuts. It doesn't work, and everybody's figured it out. But a rational, you know, going back to rational policies, policies that are actually, when you ask people on a policy by policy basis, they by and large agree. You know, they're absolutely with us. Yeah.
One question: you brought up corporate welfare.
Yes, sir.
these corporations. This is the way I see it anyways. They go around asking for all these tax incentive programs, et cetera.
Yeah, Walmart's one of the big ones. You know, we'll come into your community if you'll give us tax cuts, tax rebates, tax this, tax that.
Why is it nobody seems to realize? Now, I'm not what you'd call an economic wonder child by any means, but why is it nobody seems to realize that somebody besides that corporation has to make up for those lost tax dollars? Does not the little guy realize not only do they get an abatement, but then they have to make it up on top of it?
Yeah, well, see, the theory is that the increased economic activity from having the Walmart in the area
is going to cause other businesses nearby. You know, you're going to have all these people working for Walmart, and they're going to get a paycheck, and then they're going to go to the local supermarket, they're going to go to the local restaurant. And what it completely misses, and there's been some really good studies done on this, is that so many of the folks who work at Walmart end up getting various kinds of government assistance that we're subsidizing Walmart to the tune of billions of dollars a year. Because they pay their employees so poorly, and that when they come into local communities, they actually suck money out of them, and that the businesses that they're putting out of business, and I believe the last number I saw was that the average Walmart puts out of business 134 businesses in a community over a 10-year period. There's an excellent little book. You can read it in an afternoon. It's about 100 pages, called How Walmart is Destroying America. And it just, you know, it's all facts and figures and stuff.
Is that one you can get from any bookstore?
Yeah, you can, and you can get it on Amazon and whatnot. It's just, okay. You know, it's absolutely amazing. They've updated it a couple of times now. And,
Tom, thank you very much.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. But that's the theory, that's what they promote, is that, you know, Walmart is going to help us all out, or the big box retailers in general. I shouldn't just pick on Walmart, because they are just emblematic of a growing trend, which is this, you know, bigger fish eating the medium-sized fish until there's nothing left but the big fish. And then there's nothing but us little tiny fish, and we got to look out or the big fish will get us, kind of thing. And it's just, it's the economics, it's social Darwinism, it's economic Darwinism. And it produces the world that Charles Dickens chronicled in A Christmas Carol, where you've got Scrooge and Marley, you've got the, you know, the business owners doing just fine, thank you very much, pretty much however they want to do it. And then you've got the world of the Bob Cratchits, the working class, terrified that if they speak up, they'll lose their job, working as many hours as is necessary, putting up with abuse from their employers because they're terrified. They're scared to death. You know, Bob Cratchit was paid 15 shillings a week, which is about, 20 shillings was a pound back then, so that's about 200 pounds a year. And a pound was about $5 back then, so that's 2 times 5. What is that, about $1,000 a year, something like that? In those days, which would probably be the equivalent of maybe, I don't know, $4,000 or $5,000 a year in these days. And that's the, you know, do away with the minimum. I mean, if you're making the minimum wage, $5 an hour, you're right back in that neighborhood, well below the poverty line. And yet the Republicans say they will not tolerate, they will not allow even a 15-cent increase in the minimum wage. What kind of world do they want to live in? It's becoming increasingly obvious, I think. Dave in Humboldt County, California on the line, listening on, is it KGOE there, Dave?
Yes, it is, Tom.
Hey, Dave, what's up?
Well, you know what never ceases to amaze me is how willful this is. The acts, the deeds of these neocons is totally calculated, and they seem not to concern themselves even a little bit with how many people they may devastate to enhance their own greed. I truly believe our whole involvement in Iraq is strictly profits for the neocons.
I think it's bigger than that, Dave. And even the guys who are enhancing their own greed, I think that the majority of them really think that their idea of society is somehow a better society than, say, FDR's idea of a society.
To break the middle class, to put people in poverty, take away their health care, break their Social Security, they see that as a noble thing?
Yeah, actually, and they wouldn't use those terms to describe it. What they would say is forcing people, putting people into a position, and this is essentially what the Clinton welfare reforms were about, and there is some truth to this. That's the problem. There's always a germ of truth in every maniacal dystopian scheme. That if you force people, if you push them hard enough, push their back up against the wall hard enough, then they will work very hard all of a sudden to try and get out of that. And you know, they'll go back to work and they'll work hard and they will build the American economy and wonderful things will come out of it. And they will figure out a way to get a better job and their productivity will increase and all. And of course, what they're completely overlooking is the fact that the system is rigged. You know, this is the big debate between folks who think that the salvation of the world comes from the change in people's hearts or the change in the system. Again, talking about Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, the essential message, I thought it was fascinating, the essential message of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens was that if the hearts of those who hold economic and political power in a society change, then the society will change for the better. And I don't buy it. I don't buy it. And it's the rationalization that is used to justify the existence of such societies, and John Rockefeller in 1917 going out and handing out nice shiny dimes on street corners in order to polish his image, you know, to kids, and a dime back then was like a buck and a half now. Those little exceptions to the rule, those little philanthropic exceptions to the rule, are the things that keep the rule going. I'm suggesting that the system needs to be changed, which is what FDR was talking about and what LBJ was talking about, for that matter, that the system needs to be changed in a way that helps enhance the middle class and builds the middle class so that people actually have bootstraps they can pull themselves up with, rather than the conservative notion that, you know, if somebody's down, you kick them, otherwise they won't get up.
I think that I'm coming to the conclusion that it is kind of a willful, mean-spirited thing. I don't see it any other way. They know that Bob Cratchit will have no chance of ever becoming the manager of the bank.
But they don't, Dave. I mean, there's always that Condi Rice story of the child who grew up in the ghetto kind of thing. Although she did, you know, get all these benefits from affirmative action, but you know they overlook all that stuff. Her and Colin Powell as well. But there is always that success story, and the reality is there are many of them out there. Of people who started with nothing and have something. And that's a wonderful thing, and we want more of that in our society. But we can't use those to justify these brutal economic policies, in my opinion. And that's what they're doing. And I think that they're just deluding themselves. I guess you and I diverge on this, Dave. I'm not quite convinced they're quite that sociopathic. But who knows? 10 minutes before the hour.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555. And mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's The Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug? The phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartman Show, absolutely, without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
Efforts to control air pollution go back several centuries, according to a new book. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Ice cores drilled from Greenland show that air pollution began when humans started smelting copper and iron thousands of years ago. But it didn't become a public issue until the 18th century, when citizen groups formed in London to fight air so black and dirty it made people sick. Joe Sherman says the fight for cleaner air became part of a morality and justice-based movement in England, which then spread to some U.S. cities by the late 18th century.
It was unjust for a lot of people in poor economic circumstances, the same way it is now. It's in a lot of ways, if not changed at all.
Sherman is the author of a new book called Gasp, The Swift and Terrible Beauty of Air. He traces people's views of air from Egyptian mythology to the present, and he examines how air pollution grew as a public issue. For example, smog began to evoke concern in the 1930s, in Los Angeles, of course. Sherman says L.A. then saw a huge industrial buildup in the 1940s to meet the military needs of a country at war, and the city's love affair with the automobile took off in the post-war boom. By the 1950s, people were protesting L.A.'s poor air quality.
L.A. was like the canary in the coal mine for the rest of the world because the same conditions gradually started to creep all over the place. So we have smog initially in L.A., but then as the automobile culture spread around the world and you had more and more emissions on a large daily basis surrounding cities, you had smog spreading everywhere.
Smog, mostly made up of ground-level ozone, is a public health problem in cities around the world. And it continues to plague Los Angeles. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Listening to you, I get the music. Gazing at you, I get the heat. Following you.
So here now, the Eskimos are seeking to recast global warming as a human rights issue. Andrew Revkin writes about this for, I'm assuming this is an AP story. It was in the New York Times. Well, it must be a New York Times story. The New York Times today. The Eskimos, who are Inuit people, about 155,000 seal-hunting peoples scattered around the Arctic, plan to seek a ruling from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights that the United States, by contributing substantially to global warming, is threatening their existence. Our nation is threatening their existence. Representatives of poor countries and communities from the Arctic fringes to the atolls of the tropics to the flanks of the Himalayas say they are imperiled by rising temperatures and seas through no fault of their own. They are casting the issue as no longer simply an environmental problem, but as an assault on their basic human rights, that being the human right to survive. Last month, an assessment, notes Revkin in the New York Times today. Last month, an assessment of Arctic climate change by 300 scientists for the 8 countries with Arctic territory, including the United States, concluded that, quote, human influences are now the dominant factor, end quote. If the Inuit effort succeeds, it could lead to an eventual stream of litigation, somewhat akin to lawsuits against tobacco companies, legal experts said. Annalise Sopoaga, the ambassador to the United Nations from Tuvalu. This is a 15-foot-high nation. It's an island. It's 15 feet high. If the seas rise, the island vanishes. Wave-bounded atolls, or is it atolls, halfway between Australia and Hawaii, said he still saw legal efforts as a last resort. Tuvalu had threatened to sue the United States 2 years ago in the International Court of Justice, but held off for a variety of reasons. But here now, Sheila Watt-Cloutier, the elected chairwoman of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, a quasi-governmental group recognized by the UN as representing the Inuit, said the biggest fear was not that warming would kill individuals, but that it would be the final blow to a sturdy but suffering culture.
us, for the Eskimo, the Inuit people, we've had to struggle as a people to stay afloat, to keep our indigenous wisdom and traditions. She says we're an adaptable people, but adaptability has its limits. Global warming, human rights. Interesting juxtaposition. Very interesting. It's talk radio for the rest of us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Replacement players may be battling it out for the U.S. during soccer's World Cup qualifying match in February. The women's contract expires at the end of this month, and there seems to be little chance for the heated discussions to reach an agreement anytime soon. The men have been operating under a contract that expired in 2003, and the U.S. National Soccer Team Players Association recently refused to attend a two-week December training camp. The U.S. Soccer Federation struck back by canceling two qualifying warm-up matches to be held in January. The Federation has threatened to send a replacement team to the qualifying rounds in Trinidad on February 9th.
United Auto Workers members working at Delphi are anxiously waiting to see if they are among the 3,000 U.S. hourly jobs Delphi is cutting. The huge automotive supplier is slashing 8,500 jobs in all from its worldwide workforce. Delphi says it's taking aggressive cost-cutting measures due to the reduction in auto production by GM and rising commodities prices. The company says it expects to lose $200 million this year. The UAW and Delphi squared off in a bitter strike in 1998 at its Flint, Michigan facility that virtually shut down GM auto production in North America. The UAW at the time was resisting what it called the assault on jobs and outsourcing going on at Delphi. According to Delphi, it'll try to achieve the 8,500 global jobs cuts primarily through attrition and early retirement incentives. The UAW has not indicated how it will respond, but talks are ongoing with Delphi over the plan to cut the jobs. One of the issues in this move by Delphi is the cost of pensions and health care costs for thousands of UAW Delphi retirees.
The man who has been on the front lines of the country's biggest recent labor disputes announced his resignation Monday. Peter Hertgen, the director of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, cited personal reasons in his letter to President Bush. Hertgen was the key negotiator in a 2002 dispute between the International Longshore and Warehouse Union and the Pacific Maritime Association. That dispute included a 10-day worker lockout and the closure of 29 West Coast ports. He was also one of the mediators during the 141-day lockout of 70,000 union grocery clerks in Southern California. No successor has been named.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Total U.S. industrial production was up 0.7% in October after a mere 0.1% increase in September. That puts the industrial production index at 5.2% higher than its 1997 average. Mining and utilities led the industrial production increase. Part of this increase, according to analysts, is coming from a partial bounce back from the adverse effects of the recent hurricanes.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find Amoeba online at amiba.net.
Support our troops. Shout those magnetic yellow ribbons you see on cars and trucks anywhere in America, and is certainly a sentiment that I embrace wholeheartedly. Our volunteer soldiers, as well as the reserves and National Guard, are putting their lives on the line every day for George W.'s ill-conceived and ill-prepared Iraq War. And every day, some more of those soldiers are killed. I believe that every one of the soldiers sent over there by Washington politicians deserves the fullest support available from those of us sitting safely and comfortably back here at home. But they are not getting it. Support our troops has to be more tangible than putting a yellow magnet on your car. That's rhetoric, not support. How many of us know, for example, that Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and gang have rushed our troops into that war without the protective armor required to save their lives from bullets and blasts? An unforgivable, scandalous failure of leadership that continues to this day. And how many of the yellow magnet people are aware of how our government, quote, supports those troops who die in Iraq? While it's been widely reported that the families of civilians killed in the horrible 9/11 terrorist attacks have received an average of about $3 million each in overall compensation, do you know what the compensation is for the families of soldiers who were killed in Iraq? It's $12,000. A spouse is gone forever. A child has lost a father or mother. A lifetime breadwinner is taken from the family. Yet the White House, Congress, and Pentagon deems that life to be worthy of a mere $12,000, even as the same public officials attend rah-rah rallies urging us to support our troops. And oh, by the way, vote for us! This is Jim Hightower saying, if you think the families of those who make the ultimate sacrifice deserve more than empty rah-rah and $12,000, call Operation Truth at 212-982-9699.
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
1 in 4 adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricidin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coricidin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coricidin HBP. Use as directed.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. A beautiful Wednesday, the 15th of December. Bright sunny day here, broadcasting from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone in the high up in the Green Mountains of the People's Republic of Vermont. Two Vermont firms actually won an award. In fact, this is our caught you doing something right. It's nice to catch people doing things right. Yeah, it's really more fun than catching people doing things wrong. So here's a couple of fine corporations. Chroma Technology Corporation in Rockingham, Vermont, received the Living Economy Award presented for exemplifying the living economy with practices of employee ownership, fair wages, and environmental stewardship. Business Ethics Magazine said, "We salute Chroma Technology Corp., a global high-tech manufacturer of fiber of optic filters,
where nobody makes more than $75,000 and nobody makes less than $37,500. There are no designated managers, and employees hold all the seats on the board of directors. Did you get this? This is a company that's doing business in several different countries. This is a large company here in Vermont, Chroma Technology Corp, where the employees all hold all the seats on the board of directors. Nobody makes less than $37,500. Nobody makes more than $75,000. 2-1. The other company here in Vermont that won the Business Ethics Award for the year from Business Ethics Magazine was King Arthur Flour in Norwich, Vermont. They received the Social Legacy Award for, quote, handing down to employee owners a centuries-old tradition. King Arthur Flour, I got to tell you, this company's well over 100 years old. It's like 150, 180 years old. It's an old Vermont company. Handing down to employee owners a centuries-old tradition for purity for both the consumer and the environment. I'm quoting now from the magazine in their giving the award. We celebrate King Arthur Flour, which for over two centuries has maintained a tradition of purity with the never-bleached, never-bromated flours, and which this year became 100% employee-owned. Well done, King Arthur Flour and Chroma Technology Corporation. We caught you doing something right, and we're really glad you're here with us doing it. It's the Tom Hartman radio program here with you. Tom Hartman, 1-866-889-8894, our toll-free telephone number if you'd like to call in. If you're outside the United States, 1-802-229-2288. The chat room, if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and just click live chat. It'll take you to the Democratic Forum on CompuServe, which hosts our chat every day, full of some of the finest minds in all of cyberspace, and certainly some of the most interesting. And, of course, there are archives of the program at whiterosesociety.org, rather, and at tomhartman.com as well. Andy Borowitz reports the White House has figured out a solution to this Carrick problem, or actually to the possibility of future Carrick problems. After an embarrassing flap, writes Andy Borowitz, on BorowitzReport.com, after an embarrassing flap over the nomination of Bernard Carrick as the new Homeland Security Secretary, President George W. Bush announced today that the White House would take the extraordinary step of Googling all future cabinet nominees. The president said, quote, looking back on it, I wish we had Googled Bernard Carrick. It would have saved us a lot of grief all around, end quote. Mr. Bush said he would have Googled Mr. Carrick earlier, but that he only learned of the existence of the Google search engine on Friday, long after the Carrick appointment had been made public. Bush said, I guess I have a lot to learn about the internets, end quote. Instead of silencing critics, however, the president's comments only emboldened those who had been urging the administration to Google prospective nominees for months. According to those critics, a simple Google search using the words Carrick and nanny, for example, yields over 20,000 separate web pages, while using a search with the words Carrick plus conflict of interest yields over 900,000 pages. At the firestorm over the failure of Google, Mr. Carrick raged. White House spokesman Scott McClellan denied that the administration did not do a thorough job of vetting the former police commissioner. He said, we asked Jeeves if he was okay, and Jeeves says he was. Mr. McClellan added that the White House is now considering nominating only candidates who do not have a nanny. But, he added, then we would have to pick a Democrat. Elsewhere, the Labor Department announced that unemployment surged in the last month, but attributed much of that to the increase in the Bush cabinet. And now it's coming out, Bernard Carrick. Boy, it just gets weirder and weirder. You know, he was having affairs with two women at once while he was married. And now it turns out that he was married to two women at once. Get this. Of his three wives, two of them overlapped. According to the Chicago Tribune today, this is from Newsday, New York Newsday story by Sean Gardner and Leonard Levitt. Investigators conducted a background check of Bernard Carrick last week. As part of his confirmation hearing uncovered that the then Secretary of Homeland Security nominee was married to a woman he has apparently kept a secret for the past 20 years. And they kind of added two and two together, taking his official best-selling biography. What's the title of this book he wrote? It's The Lost Son, A Life in Pursuit of Justice. And in it, he doesn't talk about this first wife. He talks about his second wife, though, and apparently he married her before he divorced his first wife. And so, strange things. Yes, it was the nanny. It was the nanny. It's frankly, I have to say, it's a tragedy. You know, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy that somebody who is apparently so ethically challenged ever rose so high in the New York Police Department, or that he became business partners with Rudy Giuliani, or that Giuliani apparently knew about all this stuff, or most of it, or much of it, and figured the American people would never find out, or if we did, maybe we wouldn't care. Maybe Giuliani thinks this is like, that's ethical politics. I remember when Giuliani was the prosecutor in New York City. He was the district attorney, and he had ambitions to become mayor. And the truth is that as mayor, Giuliani was considered rather mediocre by most New Yorkers. It wasn't until 9/11 that he had his moment in the sun. And there are those who question his behavior on 9/11, but that's a whole other thing. But I remember well when he was the district attorney. And he wanted to run for mayor, and he had to make a name for himself. And New York City, like much of the rest of the United States, was having a significant problem with cocaine. The Colombian drug lords were hustling the stuff into the United States. The mafia there was having turf wars with them, the Italian mafia in New York. And, you know, people were getting killed. And Giuliani was the DA. He was supposed to protect the people of New York from all these drugs. And of course, there's a whole other story that goes along with this about the drugs coming into the country as a result of Ronald Reagan's arms for hostages deal and the Iran-Contra, and they were smuggling weapons down to Air America. Actually, was the name of the CIA. Airline, right? They were smuggling weapons from Texas down to Nicaragua, and then they were smuggling cocaine back and selling it in order to get money for more weapons, and thus we suddenly had all this cocaine in the United States. And the guy actually who broke that story just committed suicide yesterday or the day before. Another thing that's got a lot of people scratching their heads. But in any case, Giuliani wanted to make himself look like he was tough on crime. And so he looked around New York City and he says, okay, let's see, I can take on the Colombian drug lords, but they have machine guns and they shoot back and they got a lot of money. Or he could take on the traditional Italian mafia, the Gotti family et al., but they had a lot of power and political influence and they had guns and they shoot back. So what does Giuliani do? He busts a bunch of head shops. And, you know, I was in the city. I remember he busted a bunch of head shops. And in one particular, and this one particular wholesaler in New York City that was selling, you know, bongs and cigarette papers and whatnot. And this one that he busted, this guy had, I don't know, something like 8 cases of Zig-Zag cigarette papers. And was selling them not just to head shops, but to 7-Elevens and everything else. And so Giuliani does his math, right? In a case of Zig-Zags or whatever the brand was, in the case of cigarette papers, there's 10 boxes, and each box has 100 packages of cigarette papers that sell for 50 cents each in the 7-Eleven or whatever. But each one of those packages has 100 cigarette papers in it. So you got 100 cigarette papers, and then you got 100 of those packages in each box, and you got 10 boxes in each case. And so is that something like 10? I can't do the math that fast. Is that 10,000 or 100,000 individual pieces of cigarette paper in a case? And so he figured if you rolled that into a joint, into a marijuana cigarette, and sold it at retail for $5 each, then a case of cigarette papers represented something like $5 million worth of potential marijuana cigarettes. Right. And that's how it was announced in the news conference. Here he is. Yeah, this is a multi-million dollar drug paraphernalia bust. We took off the streets the potential for tens of millions of dollars worth of marijuana cigarettes. And then how did he do the math? He did it just the way I told you. It was all based on how many cigarette papers they took out. And this was the thing. I mean, this was Giuliani's big moment in the sun. This and going after the porn parlors. But this, he did that more as mayor. But this was his big thing as district attorney. He busted head shops. And he rode that. This guy's always been a sleazy opportunist. I mean, that's just the bottom line. I'm sorry. I have no respect for Rudy Giuliani. And the fact that Bernard Kerik has been demonstrated to be the slimy guy that he is, you know, hustling money on the taser business and hustling and in bed with the Gotti family and having two mistresses at the same time that he's married, having two wives at the same time he's got the mistresses and going over to Iraq to train the Iraqi police force, and after 3 months saying, okay, I'll take the money, but I'm not doing this anymore, sorry. And, you know, it's just, it doesn't surprise me. And it doesn't surprise me that the guy is Giuliani's business partner. Not at all. And I don't think it surprises any New Yorkers, frankly. Along the same lines here, now we find this from the Boston Globe staff. I believe it's the Boston Globe here. The Bush administration plans to ask for between $80 and $100 billion to continue with the operations in Iraq. What could we be doing with that? Let's get into that right after this. 1-866-889-8894, by the way, our telephone number, 20 minutes past the hour. It's Tom Hartman with you, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270. If you sell a product or service, we have listeners from coast to coast and in 97 countries who want to know about you. Reach out to our national audience with our small business advertising package. You'll pay just a fraction of what national advertising usually costs. Call now at 802-229-2288 or visit our website, tomhartman.com, and follow the links to the small business advertising package for more information. Don't miss reaching a national audience now. 802-229-2288.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider the Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day.
And 4 years from now, right? Welcome back. April 16th, 1953. Dwight D. Eisenhower, President of the United States at the time, by the way. This wasn't from his farewell address in 1961, which is so widely quoted, where he talked about the military-industrial complex. This is when he was president. April 16, 1953, he said, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed." So far, we have spent $150,233,513,912. Oops, $520,000, $520,000, $530,000. It's ticking as I'm watching it. The meter is going so fast I can't say it. Anyhow, we've spent over $150,233,000,000. By the end of this segment, it will have been $234 million in Iraq. With that amount of money, we could have sent, and this administration is about to ask for another $100 billion. With the amount of money that we've spent so far, this $150,233,594,596,600,000, with that amount of money, we could have put 19,898,491 children through a year of Head Start. Nearly 20 million children could have gotten Head Start. We could have given full medical insurance, including dental, eye care, everything. Full medical insurance. With the amount of money that we've just spent so far, just in George Bush's war of choice in Iraq, George W. Bush's war to get himself reelected as a wartime president, we could have provided full medical insurance for 89,960,288 children. With the $150 billion that we have spent so far on the war in Iraq, we could have hired 2.6 million public school teachers. You think our schools might be a little better if we were to hire 2.6 million public school teachers? We could have done it just with the money that's been spent so far in Iraq, and Bush is going to ask this week or next for another $100 billion more, enough to hire another $2 billion, roughly, but probably about 1.8 million, excuse me, million more additional public school teachers. But no, we're not going to get those public school teachers. We've got to have a war so that George could get himself reelected in 2004. So he could be the war president, because as Karl Rove liked to point out, no president has ever been has ever failed to get reelected. No incumbent president has ever failed to get reelected during time of war. As George W. himself points out, the biggest mistake his daddy made was ending that war in 100 hours. If he had kept it going until the election cycle, he would have gotten a second term. His daddy blew it. With that $150,233,818,000, we could have paid for four-year scholarships at public universities across the United States for 7,283,000 of our young citizens. 7.2 million full four-year scholarships at public universities in the United States. With the amount of money that we've spent so far on the war in Iraq, just on the war in Iraq, we could have built 1,352,000, 1,352,716 additional units of public housing. We could have eliminated homelessness in America easily, quickly, with a fraction, actually, of the money we've spent so far in Iraq. With the $150,233,923,000 we spent so far in Iraq, we could have fully funded anti-hunger efforts for the entire planet. No more hunger on Earth for a full 6 years with the money we have spent so far in Iraq. It's the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception.
We're sorry. Your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please hang up.
Having a hard time connecting with someone who cares? Try the Boys Town National Hotline at 1-800-448-3000. They'll be there to help you when you need it the most, 24 hours a day. They'll even pay for the call. Simply call 1-800-448-3000.
Boys Town National Hotline. How can I help?
Time furnished by the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Replacement players may be battling it out for the U.S. during soccer's World Cup qualifying match in February. The women's contract expires at the end of this month, and there seems to be little chance for the heated discussions to reach an agreement anytime soon. The men have been operating under a contract that expired in 2003, and the U.S. National Soccer Team Players Association recently refused to attend a two-week December training camp. The U.S. Soccer Federation struck back by canceling two qualifying warm-up matches to be held in January. The Federation has threatened to send a replacement team to the qualifying rounds in Trinidad on February 9th.
United Auto Workers members working at Delphi are anxiously waiting to see if they are among the 3,000 U.S. hourly jobs Delphi is cutting. The huge automotive supplier is slashing 8,500 jobs in all from its worldwide workforce. Delphi says it's taking aggressive cost-cutting measures due to the reduction in auto production by GM and rising commodities prices. The company says it expects to lose $200 million this year. The UAW and Delphi squared off in a bitter strike in 1998 at its Flint, Michigan facility that virtually shut down GM auto production in North America. The UAW at the time was resisting what it called the assault on jobs and outsourcing going on at Delphi. According to Delphi, it'll try to achieve the 8,500 global jobs cuts primarily through attrition and early retirement incentives. The UAW has not indicated how it will respond, but talks are ongoing with Delphi over the plan to cut the jobs. One of the issues in this move by Delphi is the cost of pensions and health care costs for thousands of UAW Delphi retirees.
The man who has been on the front lines of the country's biggest recent labor disputes announced his resignation Monday. Peter Hertgen, the director of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, cited personal reasons in his letter to President Bush. Hertgen was the key negotiator in a 2002 dispute between the International Longshore and Warehouse Union and the Pacific Maritime Association. That dispute included a 10-day worker lockout and the closure of 29 West Coast ports. He was also one of the mediators during the 141-day lockout of 70,000 union grocery clerks in Southern California. No successor has been named.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Total U.S. industrial production was up 0.7% in October after a mere 0.1% increase in September. That puts the industrial production index at 5.2% higher than its 1997 average. Mining and utilities led the industrial production increase. Part of this increase, according to analysts, is coming from a partial bounce back from the adverse effects of the recent hurricanes.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Somewhere between 80 billion and 100 billion. They were saying 70 billion, 70 to 75 a few weeks ago. Now, privately, the White House told members of Congress, well, this was before the election. They said it was going to be 70 to 75 billion, and that got reported in the press. Now they're saying it's going to be 80 to 100 billion. I guess Halliburton has raised their prices. In the latest violence, the paper notes, insurgents killed seven people Tuesday, yesterday, and the second suicide bombing in 2 days outside Baghdad's fortified green zone. This is just so sad. You know, sometimes I read this news and I just want to weep. It was so and is so unnecessary to put the lives of our soldiers on the line so that George W. Bush could get himself reelected and could gain more political power. It is beyond despicable. The military also announced that two U.S. Marines and the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force based in western Iraq died in combat in Baghdad province Monday, bringing the number of Marines killed to 10 in the last 3 days. We have had more soldiers here in the state of Vermont die in Iraq in the last year than we have had, actually for the last 2 years in a row, we have had more people die in Iraq than are murdered in Vermont. Now, you know, the reality is murder rate here is pretty low. Maybe every other year somebody gets murdered. And it's usually some crazed spouse, you know, or somebody going off with a deer rifle. But I think we've lost 9, I believe, so far, people in Iraq. And this is for a state with only 600,000 people in, a little tiny state. So at the same time that we're spending all this money in Iraq, at the very same time, the Associated Press reports, many companies are dropping their promise of health benefits for future retirees who now might have to stay on the job longer and rely on government health care in their old age. 8% of employers with at least 1,000 workers said they had eliminated subsidized retiree health benefits for some workers this year, and 11% more say they will probably do so next year, according to a study released Tuesday by the benefits consulting firm Hewitt Associates and the nonprofit Kaiser Family Foundation. We are well protected by this administration from the possibility that Janet Jackson might flip open her shirt, top, whatever you call those things, and show us her breast complete with pasty on it. We're well protected from that. And yet, where are our true Christian values or Judeo-Christian values? Or religious values. I mean, where are our true human values? When we have stories like we found today here by the Associated Press, article by Sam Hananel, requests for emergency food and shelter increased in many large U.S. cities this year. He goes on to say requests for food rose by 14%. While appeals for shelter increased by 6%, said the annual report by the U.S. Conference of Mayors based on surveys of 27 large cities.
Nashville, Tennessee Mayor Bill Purcell says the bad news is that the increased demand is all over the country. Louisville, Kentucky, and its metropolitan area experienced the greatest spike in demand for emergency food, with requests rising 32%. Food needs rose 31% in Salt Lake City, 26% in Miami and Phoenix, and 24% in Los Angeles. Why? Unemployment and underemployment are the leading causes of hunger, the report said. No, it is not lazy people. No, it is not welfare queens. No, it is not people who are too stupid to work. It is none of the above. It is unemployment and underemployment, which are the direct consequence of the trade policies and the economic policies of this administration, the Clinton administration, the Bush administration before it, and the Reagan administration before that. Unemployment and underemployment are the leading causes of hunger, the report said, with high housing costs, high medical costs, and substance abuse and high utility costs also playing a role. Lack of affordable housing is the leading cause of homelessness. Now, is there no affordable housing because the housing values have gone up because Greenspan has been cranking down interest rates to artificially low levels, causing the value of houses to go up? Or is it that people don't have the money to afford the housing, even if the housing prices are going up, because they're having to work at Walmart and Burger King instead of having a decent job manufacturing goods that are now being manufactured in China or South Korea or Taiwan or Malaysia or Vietnam or Mexico or El Salvador or Guatemala or Nicaragua, you name it. I'd say it's a little bit of both, but 90% in the latter. It is our insane, insane economic and trade policies. We set this thing up. We set this thing up. This was totally predictable. And it is absolutely incredible that rational economists who actually went to college and studied economics would in this day and age be quoting David Ricardo, who centuries ago said that you have to, you have to concern yourself with this whole idea of the theory of competitive advantage, that nations should engage in international trade, that there should be no barriers to trade because nations then can assert their competitive advantage. There's an old saying in business that you want that when you run a business, you run a small company or a large company for that matter. The first question you have to ask yourself when you're going to the market, when you're going to the marketplace, is what is my unfair competitive advantage? In other words, what is it that you have uniquely that your competitors don't have? And then you use that in the marketplace. Say you have a patent on a product, so nobody else can make it. That's your unfair competitive advantage. By unfair, I don't mean literally unfair, but the thing that you can use that other people can't. It's an ironic use of the word. Or you have somebody in your company who has a particular talent, Jim Henson with his Muppets company, Walt Disney. You have somebody who has an idea or an ability that the competitor doesn't have. You have George Lucas working for you, ultimately owning the company. What is your unfair competitive advantage? Well, David Ricardo looked at this and said, there are nations that have unfair competitive advantages. Some countries make better cheese. Some countries make better wool. Some countries have a lot of wood. Some countries are rich in coal. Some countries have a lot of silver in the ground. And so if everybody is able to trade with each other, then everybody has the benefit of all those things, and everybody has a better life. And it's true. It's a great argument for unrestrained free trade. It allows everybody to rise up. Everybody's standard of living goes up. Every nation gets a little bit wealthier.
The problem is that it was a marvelous justification for free trade before the Industrial Revolution, which is when David Ricardo was writing. It is not a marvelous justification for free trade anymore, because now there are still a few unique things that you can make only in some places. You know, sandalwood only grows in certain parts of India and Southeast Asia. If you want to make sandalwood, scented whatevers. One of my favorite, last time I was in Thailand, I came back with, 20, 30 of these ballpoint pens that were actually made out of carved sandalwood. They're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. Somebody sits down, carves these things, and they got all these little figurines and things on them. And they have a pen cartridge in the middle, and so you can use it as a ballpoint pen. And the thing smells for years. All you have to do is rub it a little bit, and the sandalwood smell comes out. What a marvelous thing. Well, Thailand is never going to lose their unfair competitive advantage in exporting sandalwood pens. But that's not the basis of their economy or of ours. We've reached the point now where if you want to make clothing, if you want to make computer chips, if you want to build computers, if you want to make TV sets, if you want to make shoes, if you want to make T-shirts, if you want to make clothing, if you want to make modular houses, if you want to build jets, if you want to make missile parts, if you want to make anything, you don't have to have a workforce of a that speaks a particular language or that lives in a particular place. And so that competitive advantage that Ricardo once talked about has come down to one single thing for probably 80 to 90% of the entire marketplace, and that is the cost of labor. And so essentially now those countries that have very cheap labor have a competitive advantage over those countries that don't. Now, one of the other things that David Ricardo talked about that economists don't like to quote, or at least these so-called conservative economists don't like to quote, is that sometimes nations will use their unfair competitive advantage to harm other nations. Or they'll use it in such ways that they monopolize markets or control markets, and they create dislocations in the international marketplace. And when that's the case, it's appropriate for governments to step in and say, okay, we're going to limit the amount of that product or service or good or whatever that you can import into our country or export from our country. And that's what we've done for, ever since the Industrial Revolution started. That's what we've done with labor by tariffs. You've heard this rant before. I need not beat this too much. I suspect most of you already know what I'm talking about. That, for example, if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of tennis shoes made in the United States, and you can make the same shoes in Malaysia with 10 cents worth of labor, that when you bring them into the United States, you put a 90-cent tariff on it, so it costs a dollar towards the labor cost, whether you make them in Malaysia or the United States, then companies will keep their manufacturing in the United States because it's cheaper to ship from South Carolina to California than it is from Malaysia to California. And that's why we used to make tennis shoes in South Carolina. And when we joined the World Trade Organization, just as Ross Perot predicted, although a lot of this started with Reagan, when Reagan started eliminating tariffs to protect domestic companies, starting with steel a whole long list, all of a sudden these companies just started evaporating. Tool dies, on and on it went. So now we have a situation here in the United States. Requests for food assistance by families with children had increased this year 13%. 56% of people needing emergency food were members of families. 23% of requests for emergency shelter by homeless people were unmet due to lack of resources. 23%. Lack of resources. And we're going to ask for $100 billion more for Georgia's war of choice in Iraq to help him get reelected in 2004. And And what are the conservatives doing about this? Well, NBC confirmed over the weekend that the Federal Communications Commission has now asked for the videotape from NBC of the first night of the Athens Olympics. Why? The dancing might have been too sexy. In the Olympics! In Athens! This is such a great example. The difference between conservative and liberal morality, right? Conservative morality is about, you know, the conservatives get all concerned about how, what people do in their bedrooms or how people behave with regard to sex or in private. Liberals are concerned with how we collectively in society behave toward the rest of us. A conservative moralist is saying, is somebody having gay sex in their home? Or any sex if they're not married? And a liberal moralist would say, are there people among us? Shouldn't use the same voice for both, should I? Are there people among us who are hungry? Are there people among us who are homeless? Are there those among us who are sick and don't have access to health care? Are there those among us who are in prison and need to be rehabilitated and visited? I'm just giving you Jesus' list here from Matthew 25. This is the basis of liberal morality. We collectively want to live in a world where we are not homeless. We are all in this together. And the cons would say, forget about that stuff. Leave it to the churches. That's not our responsibility as a society. It doesn't matter. But let's check out and see if the dancing at the Olympics was too sexy. Michael Powell and the FCC, they want to know about that. Were they shaking their booties a little too much? 10 minutes before the hour.
Bonjour, my name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots, organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
This is a Workers' Independent News Service feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. Sometimes called the Supreme Court of Labor Relations, the National Labor Relations Board has recently made some decisions favoring employers over employees. Rebecca Miles has more.
One agency that's been chipping away at rules concerning workers' rights is the National Labor Relations Board, a board that was created in 1935 to administer the National Labor Relations Act. The act gave workers the right to form unions freely without being fired or harassed or intimidated, and provided a legal process to those wanting to form unions and get certification. However, the board only adjudicates on cases, and it has been unwilling to enforce rules or inflict penalties when abuses occur. One in three campaigns to form unions usually fail because union organizers are fired even though this is against the law.
What's happened is that the law and the board have become means which employers use to prevent unions from being able to organize.
I asked David Bacon, a labor historian and former labor union organizer, if the National Labor Relations Board was necessary if it lacked teeth.
The board this last year made two important decisions, for instance, which actually took away rights. One of them was the right to have a witness. If your employer is going to fire you or write you up, in the past, you had the right as a worker, even in a place where there was no union, you had the right to call upon one of your fellow workers to go into any meetings with your boss. And the second one is that the board is now considering a decision that says that employers cannot voluntarily recognize unions, that they must go through, that unions must go through this election process, which has gotten so skewed and so out of balance.
For the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Gotta fight another fight. I gotta run another night. Get up, check it out.
And welcome back 5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman, we're here with you wrapping up the day. Let's go to the phone lines and wrap up the day, as it were. Alan, you made it. You made your way to Virginia now.
Yeah.
Hey, welcome back to the program.
I was listening to Republican conservative show last night.
Uh-huh.
And they have a new reason now for invading Iraq. They're saying that Timothy McVeigh, when he blew up the building in Oklahoma, is the guy who helped them was a member of the Iraqi military.
Oh, geez. you're kidding me, right?
No, I'm not kidding you.
You're serious?
Yeah, that's what this lady was saying last night.
Yeah, it was just some wacko caller to a show, or this was somebody who was a self-styled expert, or what? I mean, what's the?
She wrote a book.
You know, that was right after Tim McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma building. You know, there was.
I'm not kidding you.
You're serious?
Yeah, that's what this lady was saying last night.
Yeah, you know, it was just some wacko caller to a show, or this was somebody who was a self-styled expert, or what? I mean, what's the?
She wrote a book.
You know, that was after right after Tim McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma building. You know, there was this big search for Muslim extremists because the, you know, I mean, at that time, the Clinton administration knew that bin Laden had sworn that they were going to attack us. I mean, this is what they told Bush when Bush came into office. Bill told George, look out for bin Laden. Al Gore told Cheney he's going to be your number one problem. And Sandy Berger told me that he told Condoleezza Rice that her number one priority should be getting bin Laden. And, of course, Dick Cheney was put in charge of the Counterterrorism Task Force, which never once met before 9/11. Condi Rice had over 120 meetings of the National Security Council. Only twice did they discuss counterterrorism. And George Bush asked them to stop investigating Saudis like bin Laden, because they may have, well, he didn't say because, but my guess is the reason why is because they may have connections to the Bush theme music. To the folks in our chat room for showing up, great to see you all. Thanks to all of our callers today, to our sponsors, particularly Small Dog Electronics and the Organic Wine Company. Thanks to the stations that are carrying our show, and thanks to you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug? The phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the